Ronald Lee's on behalf of the plaintiff. Few preliminary points I'd like to make. One, you have two parties here who are in pervious contract. It's a contract case, it's not a tort case. They're still claiming it's a tort case, saying that the UIM company steps into the shoes of the tort feasors in Parsons, which I cited in both my briefs, has specifically rejected that. The Supreme Court has specifically stated in Brege that the contract and tort cases are totally distinct. Rule 411 applies to liability insurance offered to prove fall on behalf of the tort feasor, not applicable here, even though the trial court relied on it. Now, this has got to be the first case in history in which anybody even made the argument that the jury's verdict should be upheld on the basis that the jury disregarded the court's instructions. And certainly it has to be the first case in history where the court adopted that theory. But the jury verdict is defensible on the basis that the jury violated the court's own instructions.
What instructions? To which instruction?
To disregard the fact of the settlement.
How do you know what the jury did?
Well, it's just an educated guess, Your Honor, but it's shared by, it was advanced by the defense. It was agreed to by the trial court, and I believe the same thing happened.
So I'm not sure what you're saying. The judge said there was a settlement with the other tortfeasor, and you're not to base your verdict on that settlement. How do you know that? What makes you say that they base their $8,000 total verdict on that settlement?
Because, the verdict was totally contrary to the evidence, and the only justifications offered for the verdict are not defensible on the basis of the record.
Now you're saying that the jury verdict is contrary to the evidence? That wasn't the motion you made below, was it? Did you ask to have the verdict set aside on the grounds that it was contrary to the evidence?
If you look at my motion for trial, I cited Martinez v. Chaplin in there, which, by the way, is a case that the jury found that there was negligence, injuries, damages, and losses, and they awarded zero damages. I'm very familiar with that case. It was my case.
So you're saying here that there's inconsistent. Now you're telling us there's inconsistent.
I have said right from the start the verdicts are inconsistent and insufficient.
So that's one of the issues you're raising in this appeal. It wasn't clear to me from your brief that you were raising that issue.
Well, I said so in the opening brief, they couldn't figure out what I was saying, and I mentioned it in the reply brief that I am raising both of those points.
Tell us then which verdicts are inconsistent and why they are inconsistent.
All right.
There's three verdicts here, I believe. I think it was three verdicts, by the way.
Well, his medical expenses were far more than the $2,500. His loss of income was far more than $2,500. There's no evidence to the contrary.
So you're saying there was insufficient. The evidence was contrary to the $2,500 award for economic. All right. That's not an inconsistent verdict, though. That's just one you're saying the evidence was inconsistent with the verdict. I don't think you
would. There has to be evidence you can base the verdict on. Now, if you look at the cases that they're citing, the Kepley case, and the Martinez, I cited Martinez v. Chaplin, and the Steele v. Law case. These are all cases. Well, Steele v. Law was applied on the basis that the defense professional expert witness had stated that the injuries suffered by that plant were comparable to the injuries some sedentary person would get from raking leaves in the yard, and that there was no need for any treatment. It was a testimony in this case. Even their supposed expert testified that he had 20% continuing disability from the first accident and that he would need future treatment.
I'll repeat my question. Which verdicts were inconsistent and why?
And they awarded no damages for pain and suffering. There's no testimony that he didn't have pain and suffering. He testified,
he testified that I can take a lot of pain or something.
That doesn't mean he didn't feel it.
He saw
a doctor for 18 months, starting 2 days after the first accident until 2 days before the second accident, and reported for the treatment of pain, reported varying degrees of pain, and then the 2 days before the second accident, he was reporting pain at 8 out of 10. Right.
Could the jury have concluded that pain was attributable to the following two accidents?
Not if it happened before them. It was 18 months before the second accident. There's no basis. Even their professional witness testified that he needed treatment, that he had 20% continued permanent disability from the first accident.
Well, he did get awarded, just, he got awarded permanent disability.
Yeah, they did that, and then they said he had no pain, and they said, this is, the point is, how did we get to this point where they're so desperate to defend the verdict that they're saying that the jury disregarded the court's instructions and that's how we're going to justify it? How did we get to that point? All right, let me tell you. Friday before the Monday trial, defense counsel comes in court and says he's retracting all his stipulations of the various things that are going to be admitted, such as the amount of the settlement, the not just the fact of settlement, but also the amount of settlement, the fact of policy limits of the tortfeasor, and the policy limits of the UIM insurance contract. And the judge's first reaction was, well, that comes in, I've done the passing of the, at least the policy for the settlement amount comes in.
Settlement
amount comes in. Okay. And then, of course, Sunday before the Monday trial, he reversed his position and cited the Greenmeyer case, which is not a UIM case, it's a tort case.
Well, let me ask you this. Is there any authority out there that UMI limits must be disclosed to a jury?
No.
Okay.
But
why wouldn't Greenmeyer apply if there's no authority that says?
If I was participating in an argument on Greenmeyer, I would be saying, look, why do you want to make problems for yourself by telling a jury a little bit and not telling the rest, which requires you to give all these other instructions and to disregard this, disregard that, and all the damages are going to be allocated among the various people responsible. If you don't tell them about the settlement, all the court has to do is reduce the verdict by the amount of settlement. And it's doing everything the hard way, just creating a problem to be solved. I can't do anything about Greenwater, but it doesn't apply to this case because this is a contract case. It's a UIM case. And, you know, you can certainly argue, well, it might distort the jury's verdict if they know the terms of the contract. But it is a contract, and ordinarily you can show the terms of the contract.
What relevance does it have? What relevance does a $25,000 settlement have to what they're doing in this case? In this case, they're trying, as you describe it, they're trying to figure out what were Flannery's damages, and then if those damages exceed $25,000, he's going to get more. If they're less, he's not going to get anything. That's happened here. What relevance is it to the jury that he got $25,000 from the tortfeasor?
Here's why it's important. Their position has changed now. Now they're saying they just...
No, I'm asking you, what relevance does it... I don't care about their position. Don't tell me. I'm sure.
I'm going to answer the question. If you tell the jury there was a settlement, but you don't tell how much, as I told the trial court, October 15th transcript, page 20, they want the fact in of the settlement, so they don't want the amount, so the jury can speculate as to how much it was, and think this is a greedy plaintiff trying to take advantage of poor AIG.
Or so, an underpaid plaintiff who's trying to get what he deserves. They don't know.
Well,
Greenmeyer says that, right? Greenmeyer says you don't put it in for those reasons. Now, Greenmeyer also says, absent special circumstances, you don't tell them the
same. Greenmeyer.
What were the special circumstances here that would suggest not applying that little Greenmeyer?
The special circumstances are that it's not a tort case. This is a contract case and a UIM case. Those are the special circumstances.
Why does that change this notion that, you know, the jury speculating about whether the plaintiff was underpaid or overpaid by the previous settlement?
Either we trust the jury to follow the court's instructions or we don't. In this case, everybody agrees they didn't, except now they backed off from that. But if you trust the jury to follow the instructions, tell them the whole story. I said this in my reply brief. If you do not trust the jury to follow the instructions, don't even tell them there's a settlement. Just deduct it after the fact. But when you allow, not only tell the jury there was a settlement, but they don't know how much, and then, on top of that, you allow defense counsel to repeatedly insinuate with improper interrogation that he received a large settlement and that he's not really attempting to victimize AIG, it obviously creates a situation where the jury is wondering, what do you got? What do you got?
Did counsel for the insurance company say he received a large settlement?
No, of course not. He implied it repeatedly. What did you do with the settlement funds, he asked him. Objection, overruled.
Well, he testified, did he not, that I did not have enough money to get more treatment or something to that effect?
Sure he did.
So that's a wise question.
What did you do with the settlement funds implies that, he says, did you, what'd you do? Did you pay for the bill, medical bills? Did you pay for your massage bills? Did you get your car fixed? And then he asks him about two reports, not admitted, from two non-testifying treating doctors, which is totally improper. And there's not a case they cited that exists that justifies that. And in the course of that, he just basically read those things to the jury. And so the jury, in effect, those things were admitted improperly. And then he asked them, these two reports are written to maximize your recovery on those other two cases. And, you know, again, implying that he's dishonest, that he's trying to build the system. This is not proper impeachment. All right? And then in closing argument, he gives his opinion. Well, the causation, in my opinion, you know, this wasn't from the first accident. That's plain error. I objected, overruled. He also stated we're making the same claims against the other two cases, even though defense counsel knew who we had settled one of those cases. Objection overruled. He talked about one of the reports that were not admitted, that were improperly used as impeachment. So Dr. Ohm stated that his problems as of, like, 2011 were not related to the first accident, or alcohol caused by the third accident. This is not, you know, this is totally incorrect. Also, they say as well, he's not being straight with you. He, you know, don't be fooled. He analogized to the plaintiff's claim to the behavior of, quote, my kid, unquote. And, you know, I mean, this is totally improper. It's all plain error.
Plain error in a civil case.
Is this court prepared to say that what is plain error in a criminal case is perfectly acceptable in a civil case?
This court has said that plain error is not recognized except in very unusual circumstances.
I say this is really, these are very unusual circumstances. The instructions, I will, let me submit that on the briefs and reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
Very good. You have 3 minutes left.
May it please the court, counsel. Alan Epstein representing 21st Century Security Insurance. Plaintiff argues that the trial court erred in not informing the jury of the amount of the settlement with the underinsured motorist, and that the court should have informed the jury of the amount of the plaintiff's underinsured motorist limits. Plaintiff's argument that the jury should have been informed of the amount of settlement proceeds from the theory that this was a contract case, not a tort case. Plaintiff is incorrect. This is not a contract case in which the jury was resolving issues relating to a contract. The jury was resolving only the issue of personal injury damages. The fact that plaintiff had the right to recover those damages because he had underinsured coverage was entirely irrelevant to the issue of the damages the jury was to resolve.
Does it really make a difference? Does it make a difference if it's a contract case or it's a tort case? And why would the amount of the settlement in any civil case be relevant? This offset is typically done by the judge after the jury returns their verdict. Isn't that true in any civil case?
I agree. I think the, yes, that's absolutely true. I think the implication of plaintiff's argument is that because the case arises out of a contract, the jury should be informed of the terms of the contract. But you're correct, Your Honor, it is entirely irrelevant to the issue the jury was resolving.
Well, they were informed of the terms of the contract. They were told, if I recall the instructions correctly, that he's suing for the amount of damages, and to the extent they see what he got in the settlement from the other driver, that's how much he would be paid here. I think they were told that, in fact.
Yes, but you weren't told what the amount of the settlement was.
Right.
And the settlement amount arose out of a tort claim. In State Farm versus Brecky, the Supreme Court recognized that in a UM or UIM case, there's a tension between the insurer and the insured in the sense that the insurer has the incentive to, quote, advocate the interest of the uninsured motorist in the tort litigation. The tort litigation to which the Supreme Court was referring was the insured's claim against the uninsured motorist in that case, in which the insurer was a third party to the litigation, which was tort litigation. In this case, the underinsured driver was not a party because plaintiff settled with her. But 21st century and plaintiff, in this case, were in the identical adversarial posture as the insured and the insurer in Brecky. And in Brecky, and on page 12 of my answer brief, I attribute this statement to Greenmeier, which is incorrect. I apologize. It comes from Brecky. Quote, it is widely recognized that the insurer and insured have a primarily adversarial relationship when a UM-UIM claim is presented. So plaintiff's contract tort distinction under these circumstances is a non-issue. Since any distinction between this UIM personal injury damages trial and an ordinary personal damages trial is a distinction without a difference, there's no reason why the same rules shouldn't apply. The trial court properly employed Greenmeier to advise the jury of the fact of settlement, but not the amount. In Greenmeier, the Supreme Court reasoned that the jury should not be told the amount of settlement because it would be inclined to use that amount as a yardstick with which to measure damages. Plaintiff's argument that the jury should be told of the amount of settlement because otherwise the jury would speculate that the settlement was for a large amount, which is plaintiff's argument in this case, was the identical argument that the Supreme Court rejected in Greenmeier.
Mr. Epstein, one of the reasons that the court gave for denying the motion for new trial was what appears to be speculation that the jury could have, in spite of the instruction under Greenmeier, considered the settlement amount or speculated as to the settlement amount. Could you address that portion, the propriety of that portion of the trial court's order?
It's incorrect, but it doesn't. The trial judge didn't know what the jury did either. It doesn't affect the legal issue presented or what the legal outcome in this court should be. I agree that the jury was presumed not to have considered that because the court specifically instructed the jury not to consider that. So it's an unfortunate statement, but it's irrelevant to the outcome of the appeal.
Mr. Epstein, the Greenmeier case also talks about advising the jury as part of the instructions concerning apportionment. And it's not clear to me that occurred in this case. Did that occur in this case?
There's one portion of the Greenmeier case in which the court says that the jury should be informed of what Your Honor just said.
And that did not happen here, right?
It did not happen here. However, plaintiff did not object to the wording of the Greenmeier instruction that was given in this case, and therefore waived it because plaintiff counsel certainly could have said, I object to this instruction being given at all, but if you're going to give it, here's how it should be. Never did that, so the issue is not preserved for appeal. And there's no case law that holds that not giving that portion of the Greenmeier instruction warrants reversal or constitutes reversible error, and plaintiff doesn't explain why it was prejudicial at all anyway. He just says it should have been given because the Supreme Court has language in it that says that it should be given. Plaintiff also argued that the trial court should have informed the jury of the amount of the of his underinsured motorist policy limits. For the same reason that the jury should not use a settlement amount as a risk as a yardstick, it should not use insurance policy limits as a yardstick. In Allstate v. Ramos, a District of Columbia appellate decision, and Allstate v. Miller, a Maryland Supreme Court decision cited in defendant's answer brief, the courts refused to inform the jury of policy limits, reasoning that it also had no relevance to the issue of damages. Now, plaintiff argues that the jury's verdict awarding economic and physical impairment damages, but no non-economic damages, must have been influenced by the jury's speculation of what plaintiff settled with the underinsured motorist for. If you look at plaintiff's opening brief, that is not, the inconsistent verdict issue is not a separate issue. It is what plaintiff claims is the result of the issue, of the result of the court not informing the jury of the amount of settlement. So it's not really a separate issue. And it assumes that the jury did not follow its instructions, which the court may not presume. And I don't understand why counsel is saying that that defendant is arguing that the jury did not follow its instructions. We are not arguing that. And the jury's verdicts were not inconsistent in any event. The jury could have found that, based on Dr. Ashberger's testimony, that plaintiff's non-economic damages were de minimis. They could have found that the majority of non-economic damages were attributable to the second and third accidents, so it wasn't, the jury's verdict is not inconsistent. With respect to the trial court permitting defense counsel to impeach plaintiff with Dr. Holmes.
Well, before you go there, let me ask you about the Martinez versus Chaplin case. In the opening brief, Mr. Beeks quotes that case as saying that the jury's failure to award any damages for non-economic losses, particularly pain and suffering, renders the verdict inadequate as a matter of law. How is this case different from that case?
I think in Martinez there were no non-economic damages or no economic damages, and Martinez was distinguished. And Martinez also said, we are not saying that there is never an instance in which a plaintiff may sustain injuries and economic damages, but no non-economic damages, just not here. And the case subsequent to Martinez that distinguished it, off the top of my head, Steele v. Laud, I think, and Kepley v. Kim distinguished it and held that that a jury can find that the plaintiff may have suffered economic damages and physical impairment, but no non-economic damages. And based on the evidence presented in this case, I would argue that Martinez is distinguishable. On direct examination, plaintiff was minimizing, or appeared to be minimizing, the severity of the third accident, which was involved subsequent to this one. And he began to talk about what his doctors told him about whether the third accident caused, or how much his hip injury was attributable to the third accident. On cross-examination, defendant's counsel used plaintiff's treating doctor's report, Dr. Holmes, which attributed 100% of his hip problems to the third accident. Since the report was used to impeach plaintiff's previous testimony, Dr. Holmes' report was admissible, notwithstanding the hearsay rule. Plaintiff basically opened the door. And as the Supreme Court held in Bannock v. Thomas, use of evidence which would otherwise be hearsay is permissible if used for the purpose of impeachment. With respect to defendant's counsel's closing argument remarks, they do not warrant reversal. First of all, plaintiff did not object to the majority of them, so the issue was not preserved. The plain error rule only applies rarely in civil cases, and certainly not in this one. Otherwise, it would apply in every case in which objections are not made to closing arguments. And with respect to the closing argument remarks to which plaintiff did object, plaintiff characterizes as improper, but doesn't explain why they're improper with supporting legal authority, or why defense counsel can't say what he did in this case. With respect to the jury instruction issues, the trial court properly instructed in accordance with 6:9. Trial courts are directed to follow, to use pattern instructions when these circumstances present themselves, which they did in this case because there were two subsequent accidents. I'd also point out that the jury not found in a special verdict form that it could separate damages, so the issue is moot in any event. And it is a, it is not confusing, and it is a correct statement of the law, assuming that it wasn't moot. Or harmless error. The instruction tells the jury that it is to award damages from the time of the first accident to the time of the second or third accident if they cannot separate damages. And that reflects Colorado law because the defendant is not responsible for all damages when some of that damage is caused by a tortfeasor in a subsequent accident. The obverse of that may not be true. If this was a subsequent accident, the jury could divide damages. The defendant in the second accident buys, if you will, all damages. But that's not what happened here. And I think, unless the court has further questions, I have nothing to add.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Biggs, you have 3 minutes.
I think I heard counsel say that I opened the door to impeachment because I was asking the plaintiff about whether, well, about Dr. Holmes' report. I really don't believe that's true. That was brought up by them. I attempted to rehabilitate him by using his treating doctor's report, and the court had issued a letter and then struck it. This is a contrary case. They cite a Washington case that says that UIM company steps in the shoes of the tortfeasor. This court has specifically rejected that person. In regard to the whether I made had to make a specific instruction on the failure to follow Greenmeyer suing arguendo, the Greenmeyer should apply here. I refer you to the case of People v. Syrie, S-Y-R-I-E, which I cited on the last page of my, one of the last pages of my reply brief. An objection that goes to the essence of the ruling is sufficient. And when I say don't follow this case, it's right, it doesn't apply. I don't think I have to explain to the trial court how to follow a case I tell them not to follow. I think that's asking too much. I think court has an obligation to know the law to some extent.
Well, wait, that seems inconsistent. On one point, you say Greenmeyer doesn't apply because of the contract tort distinction. On the other hand, you say Greenmeyer does apply for the purposes of the instructions.
Well,
so you have to
like
separate
I said, them. Assuming for the sake of argument, the Greenmeyer applies, which, and I say it doesn't, and I said that at the time, then if you are going to follow it, I don't have to tell them how to follow a case or tell them not to follow. All right? And there is no testimony whatsoever that would justify a finding that the plaintiff's injuries were de minimis. As I said, he was experiencing pain to the degree of 8 out of 10, 18 months after the first accident and 2 days before the second accident. It wasn't, counsel was referring to something said in Martinez or said in Capley versus Kim, and that's just dictum about we're not saying that you can never have a verdict where they say this and give no damages for that. But they didn't tell you anything about the possible ramifications or the boundaries of it. I mean, this case really should be reversed. There's so many errors, and basically the fact if you when you tell the jury there's a settlement and you don't tell them the details, you're opening door to speculation, and then when you allow a proper interrogation and closing argument based on that, you're really asking for trouble. So I'm asking you to reverse this case. Thank you very much.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both for your arguments. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course.